This is The Think Tank with Dr. Mike O'Neill, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Okay, the coronavirus is hitting the world. It's hitting our area, and there is some real-world impact. We have a most interesting guest. Mike Sweeney is an American who is quarantined on the southern coast of Spain and has an interesting set of experiences. Welcome to the Think Tank, Mike.
Thank you, Mike. It's nice to be here.
So tell me your story. How did you end up where you are? You were on a vacation. When did it start? Tell the story.
Okay. My wife and I and two other couples that we knew had planned to do a short tour, a 10-day tour of Portugal and the south of Spain. And, of course, just by paying attention to the news, we were aware of the coronavirus. We were aware that that could impact the trip. And we had we were to fly out on the last day of February, fly out of Dulles Airport and land in Lisbon on the 1st of March. And then we were going to the trip would go till March 10th, where we would fly out of Madrid. So we talked about canceling, backing out. And at the time, the numbers in Spain were very low. The numbers in the United States were low. And so we thought we'd take a chance and maybe we could slip in under the wire and get back none the worse for wear. And as you know, we guessed wrong.
So when did questions arrive in your group about there might be an issue?
Okay. We were always aware of it. But it was, like I said, we got in Lisbon on Sunday, March 1st, and it was Wednesday of that week that a member of our group got sick. He wasn't feeling well. Well, we realized it could be something other than the virus.
Could be any number of things at that point.
Could be any number of things. And when he returned to the hotel, he didn't come with us the next day, that Thursday, and they admitted him to a hospital and diagnosed him with the coronavirus. So that's when we knew. And of course, he'd been riding on a bus with us for the last 4 or 5 days. And so we realized there was some danger. And then when another man came down with it in our group, that's when we were told we would not be going to Madrid. Wasn't a big surprise. And then on Saturday morning, the 7th of March, I woke up to find a note slipped under my hotel room door that said we would be quarantined beginning immediately.
Now, you're with your wife at this point? You're with your wife at this point?
I'm with my wife.
Okay, so
yes,
they hadn't tested. They hadn't tested the entire group at this point.
Correct. And so they also said we would be tested later that day. And so my wife and I were in the same room. Of course, we're quarantined there, but we had a balcony overlooking the beautiful Mediterranean Sea, and it was a sunny day. And one day of quarantine is not too bad. It turned out we didn't get called to be tested until the middle of the night. I guess it was a little before midnight. Somebody came to our room with some masks and latex gloves and said, "Follow me." And we followed him to an elevator. He pushed the button, but did a service elevator. He pushed the button, but did not get on with us. And I was surprised that when the door opened, he had actually beaten us down. He was still there. And he led us into a room. Pardon?
Go ahead. I'm emphasizing the point. He's unwilling to take the elevator ride with you.
Correct. Yes. And that, you know, little things were making us nervous. So he led us to a room, and inside were three men in with their clothing covered, masks, the latex gloves, head covering. And they introduced two of them were doctors from the Spanish Health Ministry. And they said they're there to administer the tests, which we knew were coming. And so one of them swabbed the inside, first my wife and then me, of one nostril, and then with a different swabbed inside our cheeks And then they told us to go back to our rooms and pack our bags. And of course, like I said, this is in the middle of the night. So we did that and waited around. About an hour later, someone came and took us to a different room. And it turns out that they had wanted to move everybody in our group to one rather isolated section of the hotel. So we were away from most of the other people.
Did they tell you that's where you were going? Or did you have no idea where you're going at that point?
We had no idea. So we were, we spent Sunday and Monday in this room, our new room. That was fine. But then Tuesday, they said they were moving us to a different location. And so we waited around till about the middle of the afternoon. And first, the reason they had to separate us, we found out, we went and got our test results. I'm sorry, I skipped ahead. Tuesday, we got our results. My wife tested negative, and I tested positive. And to be honest, I wasn't that unhappy that I tested positive, because for the last week or more, I've been washing my hands 30 times a day, using hand sanitizer, avoiding crowds, wiping down things with Clorox wipes and whatnot. And I thought, they told us we would be quarantined for 14 days, regardless of how we came out on the test, positive or negative. So I figured if I'm going to be quarantined, I might as well get it over with. And so it turned out I wasn't totally devastated when they told me I was positive. All I knew then is I just had to not die. Because I'm 68, I'll turn 69 this spring, and I realize I'm getting close to being in the very risky category. I'm an old man.
So in good health, I think it's fair
yes,
to say.
So. Yes. I exercise and try to eat right. So I'm in good health. So I thought I could withstand this, and it appears that I have.
Well, when we return in just a moment here, I want to ask you to walk people through what your symptoms were and what it was like over the last 2 weeks to actually have the virus. When we return in just a moment in the Think Tank.
The Think Tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We are back with Mike Sweeney as our guest. He is an American holed up in quarantine in a hotel in the southern coast of Spain on the Mediterranean coast. Mike, we went through how you ended up where you are, but what we didn't get is what I'd like to cover now is, all right, you actually have the coronavirus. What's it been like for you?
Okay. It was actually, just like I had seen described on television and had read about online or in newspapers, for me, I went for about almost 3 days with a low-grade fever, it was between 99 and 101, and the highest it got was 101, and that was accompanied with body aches. I had a slight suppressed appetite, but other than that, that was it. That was the extent of it. And I woke up after the fourth morning feeling fine, and I have had a perfectly normal temperature and have felt great ever since.
So basically,
and so now we're a week, for the last week, I felt fine. So I feel like I have weathered the coronavirus assault.
For you, then, if I were to summarize, it's a pretty much a low-grade instance of the flu.
Yes. And from what I understand, that's the vast majority of the cases. Now, I mentioned some others in our group. We had 9 people diagnosed with it. Test positive. And two of those, both men were hospitalized. And of the nine, the ratio is six men to three women. I don't know, you know, I know that's a very small sample, but anyway, it seemed to affect more men and in our small sample, and the possibly more severely, because the only two hospitalized were men.
But they were, what were the approximate age and health conditions of the two who were hospitalized?
Both. One, I thought he looked older, but I actually saw on the Dr. Oz show, they talked about us and they said that he was 70. So one of them, but he was not in good shape. He was in poor health. And the other one, I don't know his age, but he also looked to be in the, I'll say low to mid 70s. And neither one looked to be in great health before.
Okay. Well, I think that's consistent with what we're hearing. We're hearing that 70s or thereabouts is a risk factor, but it's not really your actual chronological age, but probably your degree of physical frailty. And as we know, there's a great range within that. I want you to tell the story about how we actually get to talk to you. How did you get the phone in the room?
Okay. I didn't bring my phone on this trip. I tend not to do that when I leave the country. I'm not sure why, but my wife always does. Well, my wife tested negative for the virus. I tested positive. So the positives and the negatives in our group were separated. The nine positives were put in separate rooms on one floor above the rest of them. Who are the negatives, they're all on the floor below, and they have to keep us separated. So the negatives get to stay as long as they stay on the premises of the hotel. By the way, they took us to a hotel which was empty. It wasn't open because they aren't in their mid-season. And so we're in this huge hotel, and there were only like 25 of us. So I'm upstairs. My wife is downstairs, yet I can see her every day because I go out on my balcony and she comes by and we talk. But anyway, to get the phone, because we're not supposed to. Okay, when I'm kind of getting ahead of myself, the positives, of which I am one, are allowed to go out for exercise twice a day for 1 hour. During those periods, the negatives have to retreat to their rooms, and we go out and we don't touch anything. We don't come within 2 meters, 6 feet of anybody. So anyway, there is no way I can actually accept something from my wife. So what she did, she sanitized the phone, put it in a plastic bag, and when it was her turn out, she put it in a bush. I then, during my exercise period, came out and brought the phone in. And I will return it to her the same way. I will sanitize it, put it in a plastic bag, and get it back to her.
That's it.
So they're doing everything they can to make sure that we are not spreading the virus amongst ourselves.
Well, and you're being guarded as loosely, I guess, is guard maybe the word. But it's I understand, actually Spanish health people. It's not police. Is that correct?
Right. Right. In fact, actually, the Spanish health ministry apparently has plenty to do, because the only people we've seen have been connected with the hotel and a sister hotel. Like I said, ours is empty. And as the week has gone on, I guess with people getting sick and the big changes they're having in Spain, we're not seeing anybody. So we are very loosely guarded. They pretty much leave us to our own. But we've been very good. The people here, we don't want the people below in the negatives don't want to get it. So they're being good, and we don't want to spread it to them. And so we're trying to follow the rules the best we can.
The other story,
we don't touch anything. Yeah.
The other story I want you to tell is how they get you your food and when you open your door and all that.
Well, they come over, and of course I'm upstairs. I never knew what was happening down below, but they would set a tray 3 times a day. They set a tray outside each of our doors and knock on the door and I guess run like hell, because three times a day, it doesn't take me long to get to the door in this small room. In 5 seconds, I get there, and most of the time, I never see anybody. At most, I'll see someone disappearing around the corner. So I assume that the hotel staff did this both upstairs and downstairs, and it was after several days. I don't know if I was talking to my wife. Yeah, I was talking to my wife, and she was talking about having a conversation that downstairs, the people who tested negative, they'll knock on the door and hand them their trays and engage them in discussions. So it is, we have definitely a caste system, and I am in the untouchables.
Untouchables. Well, stay healthy, my friend. We will be back after the break. We're going to be talking about the U.S. Census, and we will have a discussion with the recently former director of the United States Census when we turn in the think tank. In the meantime, our exit music is John Lennon's Isolation. Everybody got to have a home. Just a boy and a little girl trying to change the whole wide world.
The Think Tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we are back here in the Think Tank, and our guest is John Thompson, who is the recent and former director of the United States Census. We want to talk about that. It is Census Day is approaching, and welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
All right. Simple question. People get these forms in the mail. Now, at least mine that I got says, go online and answer these questions. Why should people answer the census?
Well, that's a really good question. So the census has a number of very important uses. First, it's in the Constitution that the census be conducted every 10 years to reapportion the House of Representatives. It's really important for an accurate count to make sure that you get your fair representation, and that's at all levels of voting. In addition, the census is used to allocate over $1.5 trillion a year in federal funding, which is very important. That, again, an accurate count means that there's an accurate distribution of those funds. And finally, the census is a very valuable resource for a number of organizations, businesses, local governments, tribal governments that use it to plan and make important decisions.
It's also the case, is it not, that by law it is a requirement? It's not optional?
That's right. The census is so important that it is required by law. However, the Census Bureau, first off, the Census Bureau is not an enforcement agency. They have no enforcement authority whatsoever. But the Census Bureau believes that it's better to explain to people why it's important to respond to the census rather than try to use legal procedures to coerce them. Now, it does say on the letter that the census is mandatory by law. And that's really to make sure that people understand that this is not junk mail. This is important mail to open.
Now, one of the objections that some people have raised about it, well, who's going to get to see my answers? Could you talk about the confidentiality issue?
Oh, sure. That's another really good question. So only sworn census employees can see the information, and they take a lifelong oath of confidentiality. And there are very serious penalties for violating that oath. So, for example, you could be fined up to $250,000 and or you could be put in jail for 5 years. So it's a very serious oath that they take. And I can assure you from my time at the Census Bureau, the census employees really do honor that oath. That's one of the cornerstones of the Census Bureau is preserving confidentiality. The other thing about the census is that they will not share data, raw data, with anyone.
Raw data, to interrupt for a second, raw data means my individual or anybody's individual responses, correct?
Exactly. What the Census Bureau will put out will be tabular data that has been processed so that you can't reprocess it and reveal an individual.
And as somebody who has used census data, I can tell you, for example, you get into levels. I can find out, for example, for the state of Arizona, how many people of a certain income or racial characteristics or whatever. But as I hone down into very small geographical areas, data starts to be suppressed for reasons of confidentiality. And if anything, in my observation, the level of suppression is err on the side of suppression rather than have any time, any chance that an individual's responses would be imputable from anything you get from the census.
Yes, that's exactly right.
So one objection that I've heard from some people, and I think even some members of Congress say, well, you've got the authority to count heads, but why are you asking the question about, well, there used to be, I don't know if it is there now, or plumbing or number of bathrooms or things like that. What's the rationale and the justification for the other questions other than mere head counting?
Sure. So the census only has less than 10 questions. I think what you were referring to with the bathrooms and things is something called the American Community Survey, which used to be part of the census. The census used to have a short form that asked basic questions and a long form that had maybe 70 questions that were more detailed and went to about 1/6 of the population. Starting with the 2010 census, the Census Bureau didn't collect the long form anymore, and they went to a survey called the American Community Survey, which is separate from the census and produces more accurate data. But the questions on the census are very basic questions. It's your race, your Hispanic origin, your age, relationship, and whether you own or rent your home. That's essentially the census. And each of those data is very important to collect. So, for example, the racial data is used to enforce civil rights, to make sure that voting districts are drawn non-discriminatory. Civil rights organizations use them, or civil rights enforcement agencies use them to make sure that there's not discrimination.
I think that's an important thing often lost. That is a question you get. Why are you asking my race? What does that have to do anything? Well, if you're going to enforce laws that prohibit discrimination, unless you know the racial characteristics of an area, you don't have any basis for an enforcement. Fair point?
That's exactly right.
So tell me how you are a career census. You were a career census official, as I recall, but your appointment was presidential. Is that correct?
That is correct.
What is the who appointed you and what did that process look like?
So I was appointed by President Obama, and then I was confirmed by the U.S. Senate to be in my position. There's a lot that goes on there. There's a lot of vetting, background checks, to make sure that that I qualify to be appointed. And then the Senate had to actually, vote to confirm me.
Now, many of the recent directors I know were outsiders. I think your appointment, but you, an inside career person at the census, that was fairly unusual, was it not?
Well, I had actually, it's not. I had left the Census Bureau to go work in the private sector. I left in 2002 after the 2000 census, and I came back as director in 2013. Another director of the Census Bureau, a person named Lewis Kincannon, had also been at the Census Bureau previously. He was the deputy director of the Census Bureau, and he left and went to work in Europe, and then he came back as director as well.
So the census director serves, is it a term of office, or do you serve at the pleasure of the president?
Right now, it's a five-year term, and you can be reappointed for one additional term. And it's set up so that it starts in the year ending in six and ends in the year ending in one, and then starts in the year ending in two and ends in the year ending in six. And that's the idea behind that is to have a director that's there in time to be there through the entire census as the census is collected.
Now, I have a very specific question. It's a follow-up on the first half of our show. We interviewed a fellow. His name is Mike Sweeney. He is quarantined in the south of Spain because he was diagnosed as having the coronavirus. He's not in the country, may not be on the country on census day. How's he supposed to get counted? What's the mechanism?
So the first question is he temporarily overseas in Spain, on a vacation or on a business trip, and had every intention to come back.
Yeah, intend to return, absolutely. But he may not be back. When he can come back depends on his medical condition.
Right. He should be counted in the United States.
What's the mechanism for counting him?
So the mechanism would be, first off, he'll get a notice in the mail. Which he won't get
yep.
To pick up. But eventually, if the Census Bureau doesn't get a response from his home, they will send someone out to knock on his door and collect the information. And if he's not there after a few attempts, they will actually ask neighbors who are the residents of the house. There's a good chance he'll be counted, and the in-person follow-up for those that don't self-respond starts, well, right now it's scheduled to start in the middle till the end of May. The Census Bureau has said they may have to delay that somewhat, depending on what happens with the coronavirus.
My God, that's a total unknown, is it not? I mean, it may be worse in May than it is in April.
It might be. Yeah. And the good thing is the Census Bureau has been very open up to this point about what their plans are, what they're doing. So they've talked about how they're modifying their plans to count college students. They're looking at modifying their plans to count homeless and people institutions. So they've been very open about what they're doing, which is really excellent, so that everyone knows what to expect. The big message, though, right now that the Census Bureau wants to get out is that it's more important than ever to self-respond. And there's three ways to do it. You can do it by telephone, you can do it by mail, and you can do it by the internet.
Okay, we'll be back with John Thompson, recent director of the United States Senate, in just a moment in our concluding segment of the Think Tank.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We're back with John Thompson, recent director of the census. I want to ask you a question about the funding of the census. There was a controversy, and it was around the time that you left. I don't know if those two things are related, but there was a denial by Congress of a supplemental funding. Do you think the census was adequately funded by Congress?
Well, that's a good question. So when I got there, we had developed a plan to do the census for roughly about the same price as the previous census, unadjusted for inflation. And that involved an aggressive use of automation, primarily. What happened, though, was we also needed a certain amount of budget to put all of the innovations in place. And between 2012 and 2017, fiscal year 2017 and fiscal year 2012 in the federal government, the Census Bureau was underfunded by the Congress by over $200 million from what we requested. And that had the effect of forcing us to prioritize our activities, and we did prioritize on a few aspects of the automation. We wanted to try to get rid of paper and pencil as much as possible, especially for the operations designed to collect the information from those who don't self-respond, because we didn't think we could do a paper and pencil operation in 2020. Mm-hmm. And we also wanted to make sure we could offer the internet as a response option. But that had the effect that it deferred certain activities and therefore increased the cost of the 2020 census to what it is today. And I believe it's estimated to cost about $15.6 billion.
And what's your assessment of the adequacy of that?
At this point, the Census Bureau and the Congress has really stepped up and fully funded the census, in fact, and provided a good contingency. So right now, the Census Bureau has good funding. They have the funding if they need to delay the census, which would raise the cost more. They have the funding to do that. So right now, they are in good shape as far as the funding goes.
Now, if you say there's also contingent fundings for things like, oh my God, the coronavirus, it is unfathomable to me the ways in which that could impact the collection of data. Not so much if everybody responds, gets their mail, goes to the internet and fills it out, it's quick, it's cheap, and it's complete. But I assume most of your cost and activity is around those people who don't respond to that.
No, I started working on the census in the 70s, and that has been the biggest cost driver of the census. It's, you know, to collect the information from those that don't self-respond. It's a massive operation. The Census Bureau has to hire over 500,000 people, and they have to support them. They have to build the infrastructure, which is offices and supervisors, to put that workforce out. So that is the most expensive part of the decennial census. So, and it's going to be a challenge for the Census Bureau, this census, particularly, you know, due to the coronavirus.
And that was almost unanticipatable. I don't know. Maybe you had some contingency plans in there, but most of our society seems woefully unprepared for what we're going through right now.
Yeah. So the Census Bureau they have what they call a risk register, and that was certainly on the risk register. We hadn't built out all the contingency plans when I was there because we hadn't really finished the complete design of the census. So we had to finish the complete design, you know, before you could build contingency plans. But I would think that this coronavirus has caught everybody. Everybody is reacting as fast as they can, you know, I mean, and the situation changes every day. So I'm in Oregon. Yesterday, the word came down, you know, that restaurants are closed, bars are closed, schools have been closed. So this is, you know, this is an evolving situation, and it's requiring a lot of resilience and adaptability on everyone's part, including the Census Bureau.
So, just to follow up on the earlier question, there was a budget request some years back. It was around the time that you left the census. Did the budget denial of budget have anything to do with your leaving the census, or was that completely external to that?
No, it didn't. That's not why I left the Census mm-hmm. Bureau. I was halfway through an additional term, so my appointment was extended 1 year by the Obama administration, and at the start there wasn't anyone, you know, at the Department of Commerce in a political role. Wilbur Ross came in. Wilbur Ross started building up his team. And by the time I left, you know, Wilbur had a good team, and I didn't need to be there. It was time for me to move on and let the career people at the Census Bureau work, you know, with Wilbur Ross's team.
Is the current director of the Census a career person?
No, he's a political appointee. His name is Dr. Stephen Dillingham. He was appointed by President Trump and was confirmed by the U.S. Senate.
Okay. Last question, and take your time on this. So let's say somebody doesn't hear from the census and they're afraid of getting missed. Is there anything proactively they can do?
Yes, there's a couple things they can do. One, they can call in. It's not hard to find the Census Bureau telephone number if you go to the website. The other thing they could do is they can get online, and they can just come in and enter their address and fill out their information that way.
And another point, and this is gets to the sensitivity, the census is not just for citizens, am I right?
You're exactly right. The census counts everyone. Citizens, non-citizens, it doesn't determine whether someone is legally here or not legally here. In fact, they don't ask that question. It counts everyone.
There is no, I think as you noted before, there is no, that data doesn't get released to any other agency. It doesn't go to law enforcement. There's somebody who's not a citizen should have no concern about.
That's exactly right. Non-citizens and legal or illegal should have no concerns about filling out the census. Their information will be completely confidential.
And as you noted, there's I forget how many trillions of dollars every year allocated on the basis of this. That's the core reason why you should.
Well, that's one of the important reasons. There's representation and funding, political representation and funding. And it's $1.5 trillion a year that's allocated on the basis of the census.
Thank you very much. John Thompson, former director, United States Census. We'll see you next week in the Think Tank.
The morning lights, the streets that lead.